Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. In connection with the Science and Technology Forum, we organized tonight's event. And I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences to the Commonwealth Club. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Joel Fagins, Professor of Physics at UC Berkeley, and an expert, you know, field of interest in antimatter and bicycles. Those are his two fields. So you can ask any question you want to about bicycles, but he's here to speak about antimatter. And oh, this is a little like the dolphin show, you know, at the parks. So if you don't want to get caught in the Big Bang or antimatter explosion, I think move to the back of the audience. Okay. Professor Joel Fagins.
Thank you. Well, thank you for coming this afternoon, evening. I'm going to be talking about my current area of research, which is antimatter, and in particular, trapping of antihydrogen and studying the properties of antihydrogen. But despite most of you having watched Star Trek or something like that, in your youth, you probably don't have the greatest idea of what actually antimatter is. So I'm going to start off actually giving a general introduction to why one would be interested in studying an antimatter, and where does antimatter fit into the bunch of things that are out there. So actually, I think we can call this a humanities lecture, because this is going to start out with one of the greatest humanists that ever lived, or at least it will if this is working. Okay, let's try this again. All right, we'll do it this way. Benjamin Franklin. Now, Franklin was a great humanist, but he was also a great physicist. And he postulated that there are negative and positive charges in the world. We now know that these charges are typically carried by particles, which are called electrons and protons. Electrons, as I'm sure you all remember from way back in elementary school, are negatively charged particles, while protons are positively charged particles. It's actually easy to see this, and if I had remembered to bring all of the parts of this demonstration, which I didn't, I could have shown you the difference between positive and negative charges. But briefly, I'm not going to actually be able to do anything here, but by rubbing this piece of X-cat on this ball over here, there's a story here. I'm not sure I believe it, but one of the great things about working in the Berkeley Physics Department is that we have an enormous collection of lecture demonstrations which goes back 100 years. And supposedly, this was some professor's dearest cat, and he couldn't part with it, so he turned it into a lecture demonstration. But never mind. Anyway, if I rub this on this styrofoam ball, it becomes charged up with electrons. And if I put it close to my face, I can feel the hairs in my nose getting tingled, but you can't actually see this. I've had a better demonstration of this later on, but we're just going to have to move on. In any case, so we've got positive and negative things, and that's two out of the three basic building blocks in the universe. The other one, put them together, of course, and we get atoms like hydrogen. So a hydrogen atom in this sort of embarrassingly simple model of a hydrogen atom is a solar system model, which I'm not even technically allowed to talk about, which has an electron circling around the proton as if it was a planet circling around the sun. But in any case, all we have to do is add neutrons to this mess, and we've got the periodic table of elements. We can synthesize all of the atoms in the universe. In other words, this is all of chemistry, a very boring subject in my opinion, because it's all done. It's all in that table. Physicists did it a long time ago. We can't do anything practical. You leave that to chemists, but, you know, let's get on with it. So, what else is there? Was that it? Well, around the turn of the last century, it became obvious that that wasn't all that was there, because things were radioactive. Becquerel and the Curies discovered that every now and then, atoms emitted particles, and those particles went flying off. And when they went flying off, I'm actually having troubles here. When they went flying off, never mind. Flying off, they emitted particles. But particles are generally not antimatter particles. antimatter, the story of antimatter, started with a great physicist named Dirac. And in a series of papers from around 1928 to 1931, Dirac predicted the existence of positive electrons. Remember, electrons are normally negatively charged. He predicted that there were positive electrons in the world. And these electrons were identical, or these pseudo-electrons were absolutely identical to normal electrons, except that their sign of the charge was actually flipped. And it's interesting to contemplate how he came up with this idea that there would have to be positive electrons, which are now called positrons, by the way. It's an amazing story about human imagination, I think. Don't worry, there's not going to be any math in this equation, but Dirac came up with this equation over here, which is now called Dirac's equation. It's a very complicated equation. I even understood it back in graduate school. And this equation, when he wrote it down, which was an act of pure imagination on his part, when he wrote it down, he tried to solve this equation. And his solution had problems because it would blow up every now and then. His solutions, which should have stayed small, would every now and then become infinite. And because of this, he didn't like this version of the equation. He thought something was wrong. But then he realized that if he allowed for the existence of positive electrons, these mathematical blow-ups in this equation would go away, and everything would be finite, everything would be real. And that was the basis of his prediction of a whole mirror universe out there of antimatter. It was at that time just a prediction when he made it, but very soon after, positrons were actually discovered in balloon experiments by a guy named Carl Anderson in 1932. And this is a picture or an image of one of the first positrons that was ever discovered. It's kind of hard to see here, but this is a track, which you can, those of you who are up front can see, but I doubt that the people in the back can see very well, unless your eyesight is much better than mine. But in any case, it's a track which was left behind by a positron as it went through his apparatus over there. And he was able to identify this as a positron. Where did the positrons come from? Well, the place the positrons came from is something called cosmic rays. Positrons are created in what are called cosmic ray showers. Our Earth is constantly being bombarded by energetic particles, some of them from the sun, but actually most of them come from much, much further away, different galaxies even. When these energetic particles hit the top of our atmosphere, they make collisions with the atoms in our atmosphere, in particular with the nuclei up in our atmosphere. And these collisions split those nuclei that are up there, creating other particles. So, for instance, a proton can come in, and it hits, say, an oxygen molecule right over here. And when it does that, that oxygen nucleus splits up into all sorts of things, including particles which are very strange called pions. There are lots of different types of pions. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to mention them further here. But the pions split still further up into particles called muons. Now, muons are interesting because those are relatively long-lasting particles. By physics terms, they last forever. They all last all of about 2 millionths of a second, which you might not think is very long, but 2 millionths of a second is long enough for them to get from the upper atmosphere down to Earth. And as you sit here listening to this talk, on the order of 100 muons per second are actually going through you all the time as we sit here. I can maybe show you some of those muons. This is a demonstration which is touchy. But I have an apparatus called a cloud chamber here, and if it's working properly, which it might not be, but we'll find out in a minute, if it's working properly, we may be able to see some muons coming through the apparatus. You're steering, what it actually is this thing that's buried underneath this plastic bag over here. And we're staring down at it. Oh, there went one. So it is working at the moment. There's a gas of alcohol in here, which is evaporated out. And it's a superfluid gas of alcohol. It wants to condense. So when a particle comes through it, that particle leaves a train of bubbles behind, which we can see. And so every time you see something appear over here, like that over there, that was a particle that went through the apparatus. Now, some of them are just the average, everyday background radiation. As we live, there's always things like uranium and things much less exotic than that that are radioactive. For instance, if you have any plates that have a yellow dye in them, they're probably radioactive, slightly. The wicks in a gas, everybody now uses lanterns that have batteries and fluorescent bulbs. But in the good old days, we had these gas lanterns that you might have taken camping. There was a wick in them, and for reasons that I don't actually know, those wicks are quite radioactive. Smoke detectors are radioactive. There's a lot of natural radiation around. And there's some radiation here which causes some of these tracks, probably that one and probably that one. But every now and then, you'll see a real streak. I hope some of you have seen some of these while I was talking. You'll see a real streak that goes through this apparatus. And we can sit here. Well, there's one. That was probably a muon that came through. And that, as I said, was a particle that was made in our upper atmosphere and came all the way down to Earth, some 100 kilometers or so, came all the way down through the Earth. And I didn't see it. But these things are always going through you. Now, you may wonder, is that dangerous? The answer is yes. Occasionally, these things cause cancer. This is why, for instance, people who live in Denver have a slightly elevated cancer rate, because they're closer, they're higher up, so there are more of these things coming down through them, and so they get just a little bit more radiation from this process. But it's a small effect. Most of the time, they just go right through us, and it's pretty harmless. Okay, so my next trick is to get rid of that. So I have to, this is tricky, and oh, somehow or other I succeeded. Okay, so why was I concentrating on muons? Well, every now and then, one of those muons themselves, they're actually unstable. And muons and these other particles, the pions come, and they sometimes decay into gamma rays. And the gamma rays sometimes make positrons. So our upper atmosphere has a constant steady stream of these antimatter electrons coming down and hitting us. Or perhaps not hitting us, but that's what Carl Anderson saw in his apparatus back in 1932, the first positrons that were discovered. Since then, we know of other sources of positrons. For instance, one other source of positrons is... Oh, so here's a depiction of one of these showers. This is just a picture. It's not real, but it shows you that all sorts of things can come down from one particle starting at the top. But anyway, one source of positrons is bananas. Bananas contain an isotope of potassium, potassium-40, which is radioactive. And most of the time, there are many different ways that potassium-40 is radioactive. I'm kind of hungry, so I'm going to eat this banana. There are many different ways that potassium is radioactive. But about 10% of the time, the potassium, the radioactive isotope of potassium, actually emits a positron. So you start out with normal matter, normal potassium, and it gives off an antimatter electron. So, and a result of having eaten this banana, the potassium will stay inside my body for... Any doctors here? Anybody willing to admit to being in the meta? How long does potassium stay in your body? I think about 60 days. Does that sound right? So for about 60 days, the atoms that I've eaten in this banana will stay inside my body, and a very small number of them will have this radioactive decay, because this is actually a very long-lived isotope. But as a result of that, of eating this banana, there'll be about 100 positrons emitted inside my body from eating this. So, it's a good thing to know. Next time you eat a banana. But there's actually positrons that lately have become much more important in the medical community. There are artificial sources of positrons that we can make. For instance, one of the most potent ones is an isotope of sodium called sodium-22, and that's actually quite dangerously radioactive. Nonetheless, these and similar isotopes are used in something called positron emission tomography, which is one of the latest techniques in the medical field. Basically, they get somebody to swallow some of this substance, or they inject it into your body, and it emits positrons, and where those emissions came from can be detected so that you can get an image which looks something like that. And the reason why this is a very powerful technique is that if you attach this radioactive sodium, say, to some other more complicated compound which is absorbed in some particular place inside of your body, you can image that particular place. In particular, you can image metabolically active regions. Yes, actually, I also had a similar technique with radon once. But in any case, you can detect what regions of your body are metabolically active. And unfortunately for this poor person, that's a tumor in his liver, if I'm not mistaken. Tumors are metabolically active, so you're going to get more radiation. Lately, you've probably been reading a lot about using positron emission tomography to map people's brain activity. So where you're wherever you happen to be thinking will have the most of these radioactive chemicals going to you, and you can detect it. But, okay, fortunately, I'm not a doctor, a real doctor. So I have a doctor of philosophy. So this is a humanities talk. So anyway, so what about other things? Are there more types of antimatter? Well, there are things called antiprotons, which also turn out that just like anti-electrons, except they're going to be the mirror image of a proton. Instead of being positively charged protons, they're negatively charged protons. And they're thought to be otherwise identical to protons. Now, the Bay Area, particularly Berkeley, actually was the discoverer of these particles. The antiproton was first discovered at the Bevatron, which was a machine at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, just above the hill in Berkeley, and two of my fellow faculty members, I lower the scale of the department, I believe, but in any case, two of them were Segrais and Chamberlain, received the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the antiproton way back in 1955. So, let's sum up for the time being. Matter is negative electrons and positive protons. Antimatter is positive electrons and negative protons. And so what? If they're absolutely identical, why would anybody, aside from the swap of charge, why would anybody care about this? Well, what's so special about antimatter? One of the things that's special about antimatter, well, actually special about matter and antimatter together, is that they don't like each other. Put two of them things together, and they will blow up. And you'll get a big explosion. All of their mass of the proton and the antiproton will turn into energy via Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared in one big explosion. So matter and antimatter don't coexist. In fact, it's extraordinarily explosive. Who here had the misfortune to see the movie Angels and Demons? Or read the book? More than a few. Not an experience I'd recommend. I had to see it for professional reasons only. But for those of you who saw the book or read the book, you know that the plot of this centers around stealing some antimatter from a research laboratory in CERN, in Switzerland, called CERN. That's also where I spend a great deal of time. And they stole about 0.25 grams of antimatter. This is equivalent to about 10 grains of rice in mass. So how big an explosion could that possibly cause? Well, in the book, they claim that it would blow up the Vatican. And in fact, that's correct. Those 10 grains of rice would, for better or worse, make an explosion which was a more or less equivalent to the atomic bombs that were developed, partially in Berkeley, and used in Japan, a 10 kiloton explosion. So it's an enormously powerful explosion. It's the most powerful explosive material. The mixture of matter and antimatter is the most explosive material that we know of by many, many orders of magnitude. So why isn't the military interested? Well, every now and then they are, but the problem is economics. Antiprotons are still made the same way they were made back in the Bevatron in Berkeley back in 1955, which is to say they're made by slamming protons into some metal like iridium or tungsten or something like that. The protons have to be extraordinarily energetic, but when they hit the iridium or the tungsten, they rattle around inside the nuclei inside there, and every now and then, at a very low efficiency, an antiproton is spit up. And this is just an enormously expensive process. First of all, the protons have to be enormously energetic, and then only about one time in a million, even when you've got the whole process well-tuned, does one of those protons turn into an antiproton. The net result, this is a fundamental physics. This isn't going to change by some person down in Silicon Valley coming up with a better way of actually doing this. The net result of this is that to make 1 gram of antimatter, the sort of quantity that was used in the bomb in Angels and Demons, would require the entire world's energy production for thousands of years. How many thousands of years is in dispute? But thousands of years is a good enough answer for the purpose of these purposes. So we're not going to see any antimatter bombs, which I guess is a good thing. Perhaps a bad thing is that antimatter would be the perfect fuel to get to the stars. You could send a probe to the stars with a thumbful of antimatter or so. If you wanted to send something like a 747 to the stars, something big enough to have a life support system, then all you would need is about the weight of the battery in your Prius. And since this is San Francisco, half of you have Priuses. So, but it's not going to happen. So, why study antimatter? It blows up, but so what? We can't use it for anything useful. It seems to be identical. Well, one good reason to study antimatter, my principal motivation is it's simply fun. You know, it shows up in the science fiction, right? I went to an art exhibit not far from here about 2 years ago, and the art exhibit was showing promissory notes in antimatter. I actually bought one of these things for about $15. But anyway, it's kind of fun. All right, we're not going to discuss it for that reason. There are more serious physics reasons why. And once again, we can come to a connection with humanities. We are, of course, human. So the most fundamental question we have is, how did we come to be here? And that answer depends a lot on antimatter, as I'm about to show you. We exist because there's almost no antimatter in the universe. Why? If there was a lot of antimatter in the universe, what do you think would happen to us? We would blow up. In fact, There's, at least in physics story circles, a very famous poem, which I'm now going to read to you. Well up in the troposstrata, there is a region stark and stellar where on a streak of antimatter lived Dr. Edward Antiteller. From fusion's origin, he lived unguessed and unawares of all his anti-kith and kin and kept his macassars on his chair. What is a macassar? I'm not sure. I know what an anti-macassar is. But anyway, one morning, idling by the sea, he spied a monstrous girth, a tin of monstrous girth that bore three letters, AEC, Atomic Energy Commission. Out stepped a visitor from Earth, then shouting gladly over the sands, met two who in their alien ways were like as lentils, their right hands clasped, and the rest was gamma rays. Because one of them was matter and one of them was antimatter. If there was a lot of antimatter around, we wouldn't be here. At least if there was a lot of antimatter around lately. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of antimatter around lately. How do we know this? Well, when matter and antimatter meet, it blows up, as I just told you, but it blows up in a very characteristic fashion. It emits gamma rays of precisely a precise energy, 511 kV, and we can look for those gamma rays. And actually, we can find some in the center of our galaxy. There's a little cluster of gamma ray emission of just the right thing. So we know that there's some antimatter-matter annihilations going on in the very, very center of our universe. But it's not very much. It's really very little. And in fact, there's even stronger proof of this from a mission that was just recently came back from the space station. It was flown up there by the shuttle. It was called the AMS mission, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And what this mission looked for was heavy antimatter, like helium atoms. Why? Because if there were antimatter stars, they would make anti-helium. Our star is constantly making helium. It turns hydrogen into helium. That's the way it works. Well, an anti-star would turn anti-hydrogen into anti-helium. And this detector was designed to search for some of that anti-helium. It doesn't exist. It found essentially nothing out there. But physicists being persistent ones, there's an AMS-03 mission going up. This was actually the second one. There's a third one, which is going to set limits of even 1,000 times better on this sometime in the future. Okay. So there's not a lot of antimatter in the universe, but it wasn't always that way. And this is a fundamental mystery that we have. Because for the 14 billion years ago, the Big Bang should have produced nearly equal amounts of matter and antimatter. In fact, precisely equal amounts of matter and antimatter. Everything should have gone away. And we should not be here to ask the question of why we are here. Because we should have, well, our precursors should have annihilated against each other. Now, the laws of physics are actually quite rigorous on this, that the Big Bang should have produced exactly as much matter as antimatter. And yet it's obvious that it didn't, because we are here. We're left behind. So what must have happened is that, in fact, the Big Bang didn't produce precisely as much matter as antimatter. It produced a little bit more matter. Just a tiny little bit more matter than antimatter. Most of this all annihilated, but it left just enough for us to be able to ask the question of why we are here. And nobody knows why this happened. It's one of the grand challenges in physics, in fact, in all of science, is to try and understand why it is that the Big Bang produced more matter than antimatter. And the thing that I work on, antihydrogen, has a remote chance of explaining this mystery. Emphasis on the remote, unfortunately. So, how does that go about? Well, let's talk about some of the things that could conceivably be different about matter and antimatter. Everybody knows, for instance, that apples fall towards Earths, right? Especially these days, what with, you know, the Apple Maps disaster. And everybody believes that an anti-apple would fall towards an Earth, an anti-Earth. But nobody is quite certain about whether an anti-apple would fall towards an Earth. In fact, there are some people, who no one believes, who have speculated that an anti-apple would actually fall upwards. So, not too likely, but it's always a possibility. So that's one thing that you could hope to study with antihydrogen. It's one of the things that we would like to study with antihydrogen. What else? Well, spectral measurements. You all know, observationally, if you've never thought about it, that different atoms glow with different colors. Think about neon bulbs, right? Your favorite beer sign. Or anybody here from Boston? The Cisco sign, you know, up in near Fenway Park, right? They have characteristic colors, red, blue, green. Where do those characteristic colors come from? It turns out that atoms always glow with characteristic colors. It's called their spectra. And scientists have devoted a great deal of attention to studying the spectra of atoms because it turns out to be a supremely useful, unlike the stuff I do, it's a supremely useful tool to be able to look at the spectrum of atoms. So one can ask, are the spectra for antihydrogen and hydrogen absolutely identical? Now, how could this have come about? Where does the spectrum come from? The spectrum comes about because the electron, in this embarrassing model, I hope there are no real physicists here, in this embarrassingly simple model of an atom where an electron goes around a proton, okay? And the color that the atom glows at, hydrogen actually glows in the ultraviolet, but never mind, let's pretend it's red. The color that the hydrogen atom glows at is related to how fast this electron goes around the antiproton. So it is certainly thought that hydrogen and antihydrogen, the positron goes around just as fast as the electron goes around. But perhaps it doesn't. Perhaps, for instance, that goes around just a little bit faster. It's unlikely, but perhaps that's the case. So if it goes, see, this one's beating that one now. If it's going around a little bit faster, the color will be a little bit more towards the violet side of the spectrum. And this is something that physicists can look for fairly easily. In fact, physicists are absolutely great at doing this, but I'll come to why we would look in a second. But we can ask the question, could the spectra actually be different? And actually, the answer is no, according to a very well-established principle of physics called the CPT theorem, or CPT symmetry. This is one of the deepest things that we know about nature. I'll come to what the CPT symmetry is in a few minutes, but just accept it for a moment. According to the CPT symmetry, the spectra of hydrogen and antihydrogen have to be absolutely identical. So CPT symmetry has to be broken or violated for them to be different. This is incredibly unlikely. But if one was ever to succeed in doing it, it would revolutionize physics. You'd certainly get a Nobel Prize. Fat chance. But anyway, so why should we take a look at antimatter? It turns out that we really, really can measure the spectrum, the color of atoms to an enormous precision. In principle, we can measure the color of hydrogen to one part in 1 followed by 18 zeros. Think about that for a second. I'll give you an analogy. Let's say we took some of those grains of rice from Angels and Demons, and let's say they were each 1 centimeter long. That's a pretty long grain rice, but never mind that. Absolutely identical. Now stack those grains of rice all the way from here to the nearest star, Proxima Centauri. Physicists could tell if one of those grains of rice was removed. That's really astonishing. So we can tell the color of these two atoms in principle to astonishing accuracy. We've actually done this measurement to one part in one followed by, no, three zeros. We're working on it. And they're the same, incidentally, to one part followed by three zeros. But we could tell, we can measure this incredibly accurately. And if we were ever to detect difference, the first thing that would happen is absolutely no one would believe us. The second thing after a long period of time, if people started to believe us, is that we would have proved that CPT symmetry doesn't actually occur. So, maybe what I should do is talk about what CPT symmetry is. This is a very complicated physics concept taught in the highest level physics courses. Fortunately, I'm just a dumb experimentalist, so that's the version that you're going to get of what CPT symmetry is. Each letter, C, P, and T, stands for something that can be flipped. C stands for flipping the charge, which is called charge conjugation, because why use a simple word when you can use a fancy one? P stands for parity conjugation or flipping. I'll come to what that is in a minute. And T stands for time reversal. So what do I mean by this? It's actually pretty simple. Consider an experiment over here. The experiment has some result. Now, flip all of those quantities in another experiment over here. CPT symmetry insists that the results of that second experiment are identical to the results of the first experiment. To be a little bit more concrete, charge, let's talk about that one. Let's do a simple experiment. I'm going to start with two positive charges. I'll have my thumbs on them. What happens when I take my thumbs off? What do positive charges do? They repel each other, okay? So the results of that experiment is that they repel each other. Now, let's do the charge-conjugated experiment. How would we do that? We take the positive charges and we turn them into negative charges. I have my thumbs on them. What happens when I take my thumbs off? Exactly the same result. They're going to repel each other. So that's what charge conjugation is. Time reversal is a little more complicated. But I'm going to demonstrate it to you. I'm going to make time run backwards. That's what time reversal is to make time run backwards. How could I do that? With the benefit of this demonstration over here. This is something called a Newton's cradle. You've probably all seen versions of this with four of them. But this one is slightly different and has the most astonishing behavior if you've never seen it before. Be prepared to be astonished. All right, why should you be astonished? Look at that. The second ball, the heavy ball, comes to a dead stop every other bounce. All right, who's astonished? I'm astonished. And that's what all that counts, okay? So, how can we explain the fact that that second ball comes to a dead stop? Well, I teach a lot of introductory physics, and one of the things that I teach are things called conservation of momentum and conservation of energy, and you can actually prove this using these two principles, which I'm not going to do for you today. I'm going to prove to you this with a slightly different principle, okay? What I'm going to do is first show you a movie of this. So, okay, let's play this movie. It's playing, all right. So that's just a movie of what you just saw. Okay, just get used to the fact that I can take a movie of this. And now what I really want to do is going on to the next page. Let's go on to the next page. Okay, what I really want to do is to show this movie backwards. Now, everybody of this, there are very relatively few people in this, young people in this audience. So I'm sure you all remember your old parents' movies and running them backwards. My favorite was my father took a movie of me picking a tomato and he'd play it backwards, so I'd put the tomato back on the... Never mind. All I'm going to do is run that movie backwards. And I want you to notice something astonishing. The one at the top... this one over here is going to run forwards in time, starting at time zero. The one at the bottom is going to run backwards in time, starting at 8 seconds. And here's what I want you to see, that when I run these two movies, what I want you to see is the two movies are absolutely identical to each other. When I reverse the time, I get exactly the same result. Here's an experiment. One experiment, a second experiment. I reverse the time in one of them, and I get exactly the same result. The ball comes to a dead stop. That's time reversal. So the last thing that we have to discuss is parity reversal. So how do we do that? Parity is just a fancy word for handedness. Here's a right glove. Remember, I'm a bicyclist. I brought bicycling gloves. Here's a right glove. Here's a left glove. Is there anything I can do to these two gloves to turn this left hand into a right hand glove? I can't. There's no rotation or convolution of it that will turn the glove into the other glove, except for one that cheats, which is turning it inside out, which I admit I've done when I accidentally brought two right gloves to a bike ride, but that's cheating, violates the rules. Things are inherently right-handed or left-handed in the world. This may be more familiar to you from biology. If you remember, there are right-handed and left-handed sugars, for instance. Who's heard that? And if you may know that, for instance, if you eat a right-handed sugar, it will taste good, but your body can't digest it, so it's guilt-free. The problem is that there are... Is it right-handed or left-handed? Well, all biological sugars are one way. I think right-handed. So it's the left-handed ones have to be made by chemistry. And there are just not a lot of them, so no, this isn't a practical technique yet for letting us indulge. Okay. So we've got the three elements of CPT. And if we put them together, we get CPT symmetry. It turns out that if we really want to have the same results from every single experiment, we have to invert all three of these things. We have to turn the charge around, we have to turn the parity around, and we have to run it backwards in time. And let's not get into the details about how we normally run things backwards in time. It's not by taking movies and running them backwards, okay? Just, it's one of those things. You accept it because I'm a person of authority, you can tell. But if we do that, the results of these experiments will be absolutely identical. And as I said, this is one of the deepest things that we know about the world. It really is true. Or maybe not. And that's what my experiments are trying to see. Okay. So why use antihydrogen for these things? Well, it turns out that antihydrogen is a great place to study them. So I'm going to spend the rest of this time talking about antihydrogen and how we can make it in the laboratory. Antihydrogen atoms were actually first made at the CERN laboratory in Switzerland back in 2002. And by this point, hundreds of millions of these atoms have been made. If you were able to trap them all and put them into a little box, they would make a box which is about 100 nanometers, or 10 millionth of a meter on a side. So not very much. As I said, the economics of this is incredibly unfavorable. But they would annihilate if you put them all together. In fact, they would create enough energy so that you could run a laser pointer for about a second or so. Not a lot of energy. But these were all untrapped antihydrogen atoms. In other words, they were made and they immediately hit the walls of the device. What do they do when they hit the walls of the device? They annihilate. They blow up. So we wanted to make trapped antihydrogen atoms. Well, that turns out to be quite difficult. One thing I can assure you is that our trap for antihydrogen atoms looks nothing like the trap in Angels and Demons. A more plausible thing that it might look like, well, I don't... In Brooklyn, it turns out that there's a store for superheroes which sells cans of antimatter. I actually have one of these cans sitting in my breakfast case. I forgot to bring it in, but... Okay, seriously, how do you make a bottle of antimatter? Because you have to make a bottle that has no material sides or no material anything in it. Because if it touches anything, the antimatter touches anything, it's going to blow up. So, for instance, it can't have any gas inside of this bottle. So you have to get to, you have to pump out all of the gas. And the only way to do that well enough is to cool it down to very, very low temperatures. A more serious problem is that the antihydrogen atoms can't hit the sides of the bottle. And how do we do that? What we do is to use bottles which are made out of magnetic and electric fields. I have an apparatus which can begin, I hope, to show you this. It's this apparatus over here. It'll take me just a moment to set it up because, unfortunately, only those of you in the front row will be able to see this, but I'll try and do this transformation as quickly as I possibly can. But what you're seeing over here is what you're seeing is a glass globe over here. There's a source of electrons inside of this glass globe. These two things around the outside are coils that can make a magnetic field. Could we have the house lights out, please? And if I get that viewer back on, which may... Oh, it's back on. Good. And we turn out the lights and turn this on. You can maybe start to see this. The Commonwealth Club doesn't believe in making the room lights dark. But what you can see is a beam of electrons coming into this device, okay? So here's a source of electrons, and it makes a beam of electrons. Can people see this blue faint line here? Okay. So actually, you can't see electrons. So what that beam is doing is it's coming through and ionizing the gas which is inside of this cylinder, leaving a track behind of where the electrons went. Now, those electrons, if they were anti-electrons or positrons, would just be hitting the wall and annihilating, which wouldn't be any good at all for us. So how do we get around that? It turns out we get around it by turning on a magnetic field. And if we turn on a magnetic field, which can be done by those coils that I just showed you in this apparatus, what you can see is that I can bend those electron beam into a circle and keep them from hitting the wall. Well, in this case, they come back and they hit the source of the electrons that created them in the first place. That's obviously not going to work. We need to be more sophisticated in our actual experiment. But we've perfected ways of doing that. If I could have the room lights back on, please. So what we can do is make a trap. Okay. Make a trap which is based on... actually, I'm playing a video of this, which is better recorded, and you can see it as I turn the magnetic field on again. What we can do is make a trap which is made out of magnetic fields this way. And the trap looks something like this, and I'm running out of time, so I won't go into any details. But basically what we do is we have some antiprotons, which in the trade are called P-bars. Antiprotons over here. We put some positrons over there. The trap uses electric field established by these cylinders, a strong magnetic field to keep them from hitting the wall. And basically what we do is, not literally, but using electrostatics, is we tip that trap so that the antiprotons go into the positrons, and then they're going to make antiprotons. And then we're left with antiprotons. But this is a problem. Could I have the room lights back on if it's possible? Yeah, okay. Oh, so much for that camera. So the problem is that we can't trap the hydrogen atoms that we've made by combining the positrons and antiprotons nearly so easily because they have no charge. It turns out to be relatively easy, actually, to make a bottle for charged antimatter. But antihydrogen atoms are not charged, so we have to come up with a new technique. And what we actually do is rely on the fact that antihydrogen atoms are like small little magnets. They have a tiny, tiny bit of a magnetic field. And it turns out that we can take advantage of the fact that they look like a little bit of a bar magnet to trap them into place. We also take advantage of the fact that antihydrogen atoms have something that we call spin, which you might think means that they're spinning like this, which is a good way to thinking about it, but it's wrong. But we'll run with that for this talk, is that these atoms are spinning. Okay, so how could you actually trap them? Well, I have a demonstration that shows that over here. This is a toy. Actually, some of you may have seen this toy in the past. It's a very tricky toy to set up, and I spent half an hour before this talk. Oh, thank you. Trying to set this demonstration up. We'll see if it actually works. What I have here is a top. You can all see it, but it's a magnetic top. And if I were to put it over here, it goes flying because of these magnetic fields. It's obviously not in any sense trapped. Okay? But if I set this magnetic field spinning, which I can do with my handy spinner, we'll see if this will actually work. So now it's behaving like a top. I'm going to lift it away from this magnet, and we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Well, it almost happened. I'll try it a few more times. So pretend that that top is an antihydrogen atom, and what we're doing is we're putting it into this magnetic field. And it levitates. It will levitate. It was doing this before the lecture. It's very temperature sensitive, so even all of you being in the room will have raised the temperature in the room and makes it a little bit harder. But I'll try one or two more times, and then we'll go on to something else, because I am out of time. So, believe it or not, this is how we trap antihydrogen atoms, almost. We can't rely on gravity, so we actually have a magnet which does something vaguely similar to this. And then on top of it, on the other side, we have a similar magnet. And that there's a balance point in between. And doing this, we have been able to trap antihydrogen atoms. It was a long campaign. I only got involved midway into this campaign, but we have succeeded at it. I'm going to just skip that. Back in 2009, we trapped all of six of them, but we weren't absolutely sure. And then in 2010, in a series of papers, we trapped first something like 38 of them. And I don't know if you were around, but this might possibly remember. This paper got a lot of publicity. We trapped them for only about a sixth of a second. But a few months later, we had trapped 300 of them for about 1,000 seconds. So it turns out 1,000 seconds. It turns out we probably could trap them for longer. It's just that we get bored. 1,000 seconds, this is all done at CERN in the laboratory there. 1,000 seconds is long enough to go out for coffee. You come back, and so you push the button, and is it there? But unfortunately, when you push the button to see whether or not it was still there, that destroys it. So that's why we stopped at 1,000 seconds, simple boredom. By this point, we've trapped some thousands more of these antihydrogen atoms, and we have started to do physics with them, and I'm going to skip this because I'm out of time. I'm just going to conclude by saying it turns out that it's easy to make antihydrogen atoms. It didn't seem to be easy when they first started working on it. This was before my time. But now it's obvious that it's easy. We can trap them. The rates that we're getting and the numbers that we're getting are improving. The trapping lifetimes of these atoms are excellent. And we've begun to study these physics about looking for things like CPT violation and trying to drop antihydrogen atoms to see if they actually fall downwards as everybody expects or if they go upwards, which would be really cool but incredibly unlikely. Thank you for coming. I hope you've learned something and had a good time.
So that was a wonderful lecture by Professor Fagins, and I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Fagins speaking about antimatter at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And we do have a few minutes for questions, so who would like to ask the first question? I'll bring it over to you.
When the antimatter is created, I'm over here to your right, either by you doing it purposefully or by things coming in from the outer universe and hitting the upper atmosphere, are those antiparticles truly created like they weren't there before, or are they revealed by splitting them off from something that was masking them? And secondly, what happens when they go away? Are we creating a bunch of little explosions or what?
This is humanity series, so I'll say that The first answer is philosophy. But actually, I think you can say they're actually created. One of the cleanest ways of doing this, not a practical way of doing this, but one of the cleanest ways of doing this is to take really intense laser beams and shoot the two laser beams at each other. So lasers, as you know, are photon particles, but they're not. There's nothing there. There's no matter there. And if you can make this really, really intense, then you can actually get positrons being made right there, something being made out of nothing. There's vacuum, and then suddenly there's a positron. There's actually also an electron there. It turns out that you cannot create a positron without making an electron. So you make a positron-electron pair together. And the process works in reverse. To answer the second part of your question. Oh, I should say that this is actually observed, believe it or not, lightning. It was recently discovered that lightning makes positrons via this mechanism, a little bit more complicated. But positrons are made by lightning strikes occasionally. But anyway, the inverse process, if you bring a positron and electron together, they annihilate completely. And there's no matter left. There's just energy. But remember, physicists have a difficult or perhaps easy relationship with matter and energy because Einstein's equation E equals mc squared says that they're equivalent to each other. So there's not a... If you insist on saying matter is matter, matter, damn it, then you can say that the positron and the electron, when they annihilate with each other, disappear altogether and you're only left with energy. But if you take... perhaps a more correct viewpoint, which is that energy and matter are pretty much equivalent to each other, then you haven't really managed to get anything to go away. You've just transformed it into a different state.
Does what you're doing have anything to do with establishing the existence of the Higgs field?
I work at CERN, but I have nothing to do with the Higgs field. CERN is a big complex. It's something on the order of 10,000 people are there at most points. My badge number at CERN is 91,666. Let that sink in for a second. So that means something like 100,000 people. I know my undergraduates are now getting badges well above 100,000, so lots of people have been involved in this. But we're actually a parasite on the side of CERN. CERN has this big ring that goes through the French countryside. In fact, every summer I live in the middle of that ring. And I do like to bicycle. It takes about 30 minutes to bicycle from one side of the ring to the other. There's no straight, direct road. So it's a huge thing, 17 miles around. But that ring is fed by smaller accelerators, and it only needs to be fed occasionally. So what actually happens is that they run those smaller accelerators to feed the big ring, but they also send parts of it off to our experiment, and we live parasitically on the big accelerator. So no, I have nothing to do with the Higgs field, and yes, it confuses me just as much as it probably confuses you. So...
What leads physicists to believe that bosons would behave in an opposite fashion, given that one fundamental force seems to have a similar correlative effect as the electromagnetic force? I guess in your example would be, would positrons behave in an opposite fashion, given an environment where gravity would be more inclined to bring it closer to the Earth, instead of pushing it away or repelling it?
Well, this is a really complicated question. The reason why people speculate that gravity, that antimatter might fall upwards, is precisely everything else about antimatter is flipped, so why not gravity? But in reality, there's a lot of good reasons why gravity, it shouldn't go up. There are limits, experimental limits, that make various assumptions that say that it shouldn't go up. If it did go up, it would solve some major problems. For instance, you may have heard that physicists, this is kind of embarrassing for my field, physicists have lost 93% of the stuff in the universe, the, you know, dark energy, dark matter. We thought we understood everything, and then we don't. We actually understand very little of it. It turns out that this problem would probably go away if anti-gravity existed. There are papers that have been published that say if matter and antimatter repelled each other, then what look to us like dark matter and dark energy are just manifestations of that repulsion. Well, let's be careful. I mean, there's antimatter. Electrons are not bosons, you know. So there's a whole spectrum of these things out there. But almost surely antimatter falls downwards. And almost surely this is actually a barren, sterile field. But there's always a chance that it's not. And I have tenure. So, you know.
Back to humanities, I'm interested in why it's so obvious to you guys that there ought to be a balance between matter and antimatter. It's based on the assumption that the Big Bang occurred out of nothing, and therefore, or I don't know what it's based on, in fact. It seems to me it presumes something that existed at the time of the Big Bang, or nothing existed. What's going on?
Well, for that, you should have a speaker who's a cosmologist come over here. Remember, half the time when people ask me what I do, I say I'm a plumber. That's really what I do. But the answer to that, is, to the extent that I'm able to answer this question, is that the Big Bang started out with just energy. And as I was saying a few minutes ago, when you have just energy, you can use that to cool it down, in a manner of speaking, into matter, okay? But when you do that, you always make pairs because of various symmetries that people really, really deeply believe in and are observed, always observed to be the case. So if you make an an electron, you also make a positron. And you have to make them in pairs. They always, always come in pairs as far as we know. If you make a quark, you make an anti-quark. So if you make a proton, you have to make an anti-proton at the same time. And there isn't any slop in this. All right, there actually is a little slop. It's something called CP violation. But that slop isn't big enough. Or people don't think it's big enough. Yes, it is based on those assumptions. You know,
observations only go so far.
It was 14 billion years ago. Yeah. Even our oldest physicists don't remember.
All right, we have time for one more question.
Yeah, well, you'll let us know whether this is a philosophical philosophical or a humanistic or a physics question, but there is positive and there is negative. Do those terms have any specific meaning, or are they just two opposites?
It's just a convention. So Ben Franklin said this. He said there's positive and negative, and he didn't even know there were electrons or protons involved. It's just a convention. And there's nothing deep about it. I mean, as far as the anti-Dr. Edward Teller is concerned, we're actually the anti, and he's the normal matter teller.
I think that's a great place to end it, as far as Dr. Teller is concerned. Okay, that was another lecture at the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm going to thank Professor Pagens for coming and sharing antimatter, and should we test and see if either of us is...
I'd be happy to answer questions afterwards if you want to come up.
Right, great. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much. Thank you.